It was 1987, 20 years ago, and I had just graduated from rabbinical school. And I was in Philadelphia, and my parents took me, I remember, to the King of Prussia Mall because I needed to have a suit, because now I was a rabbi. So they bought me a suit, and I was still spending a few days in Philadelphia before I came back to Los Angeles, where I was going to teach at the University of Judaism, now American Jewish University. And I got a call from a friend. And he said, you know, I have one suit. It's at the cleaners, and I need to go to a funeral. Do you by any chance have a suit? So I said to him, it happens, this is somebody that I had grown up with in Philadelphia, and I knew very well for many years, and we lived together at college, and I said, it just so happens I do have a suit. But it's brand new, you can borrow it, but I need it back before I go back to Los Angeles. He said, no problem, thank you so much. So I dropped the suit by his apartment. Day or two goes by, I don't hear anything from him. Call him up, and I say, so where's the suit? Silence. I said, did you lose it? He said, no. I said, is it ruined? He said, no. I said, so what's up? He said, I had it altered. I couldn't go to the funeral. It didn't fit. I'll alter it back, he tells me. Now, I want you to know he's still my friend. Because, after all, in the immortal words of Shakespeare, love is not love which alters when it alteration finds. But the story reminds me of a certain flaw in what is known as the Serenity Prayer, the prayer that, as far as we know, was written by Reinhold Niebuhr, the great Protestant theologian, and that has been adopted by all the 12-step groups. You know the prayer, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. But of course, built into that prayer, unless you qualify it, is the idea that you should change the things you can. But not everything should be altered. And not everything should be changed. And there is wisdom in knowing what, not only what you can change, but what you should change. And what should remain as it is. Last night I talked about happiness and human initiative. In youth, said Emerson, passion rebuilds the world. This morning, now this afternoon, I want to talk about rebuilding the world and the worlds we need to rebuild. Because we cannot forget that in the sweep of history, worlds were taken away from us only yesterday. This morning, when I came to the synagogue and there was no light, by a flashlight that was brought to me by one of the maintenance men, I was reading the book Fateless by the Nobel Prize winner Imre Kertész about his experience growing up in Auschwitz and Buchenwald, and he just won the Nobel Prize, I believe it was 2 years ago. In other words, that world that was taken away from us, it's still here. And we have rebuilding still to do. But we have to know what it is to rebuild, what it is we need to rebuild, and which worlds were stolen, and which worlds we can replace. And I want to propose this morning three worlds. They are all in their way interconnected, but all of them need to be rebuilt, and all of them are within our capacity to rebuild them. And the first is the world of learning. How many children that would have grown up to be scholars and sages and teachers have been lost? They've been lost not only to the carnage of Eastern Europe, but they've been lost to the insistent pressure of the world that has pushed us from our heritage and has made us fearful of it. Just imagine how many worlds, how many universes of knowledge and ideas the Jewish people were deprived of at the gates of Auschwitz. Too often, I am told, my child can't go to religious school or to day school because it conflicts with their schedules. They can't do it because of soccer or skating or dancing or acting. And I think those things are important and they're real, but my God, do you know what we're trying to replace here? Do you realize what we've lost and what it is that we're trying to continue? Believe me, your child will still skate and act and dance and play soccer, but what will the child do if we can't give them a little Torah? In that book that I was reading this very morning, in Faithless, the page I read right before I came down for Psukei Dezimra, he writes how when he was a child in a Hungarian school, his teacher used to quote an ancient Roman philosopher who said, "We are educating not for school, but for life." That's what we're doing here. We're trying to replace and replenish and renew the community of children who cannot learn because they were lost. And if you end your Jewish education at 13, let me tell you what it is you miss. Judaism. Because the great secret of Jewish education is we try to keep children interested and involved long enough so that we can teach them the real stuff. Because Judaism is about relationships and death and fear and sexuality and love and all the things that are real and deep and that you're not ready yet to learn about at 11, 12, and 13. It's not just about stories and heroes. It's about stories and heroism. Real and deep. That's why we're spending millions to rebuild the third and fourth floor. That's why. Because we want to draw in a generation of Jews who not only deserve it on their own, but they deserve it because for every Jewish child who studies today, there is that ghost of a Jewish child who never got to learn, who never got to study. As the Ponovitsa Rebbe said, a child without parents is an orphan, but a nation without children is also an orphan. And if we do not have our children, we do not have a people, because after all, the world rests, as the rabbis tell us, on the breath of school children. The second world we're trying to rebuild is the world of community. And the best way that I can tell you about rebuilding the world of community is by telling you about a community. My wife's father, as with my father, come from Lithuania. But her mother's family comes from a different place, a little Polish village called Mogilnica, outside of Warsaw, 9 miles outside. And I know a lot about that place, even though I've never been there. Because I have a book called Three Mogilnica, about three men who came here in the beginning of the 1900s. Their names were Max Schnitzer, my wife's great-great-grandfather, Louis Rappaport, and Isaac Markowitz. And what did they do when they came to the United States? They started to make money to bring over everyone else from Mogilnica to the United States. And they set up all the things that we needed, schools, a cemetery, a synagogue, for people who came over from Muggelnitsa so they wouldn't feel alienated and they wouldn't feel as far from home as in fact they were. I know all this because this book was written by the son of Isaac Markowitz, one of the three Muggelnitsa. His name was Louis Markowitz, and he wrote it in 1950. You can imagine what happened to Muggelnitsa in the 1940s, but you don't have to imagine it. I can read it to you. From time to time, news reached us that there were no more Jews left in Muggelnitsa. The noted American writer, Mr. Ben Hecht, described the fact in a heartrending article he published in the Reader's Digest of 1943, February 1943, how the Nazis broke into the old synagogue on Yom Kippur in the little town of Muggelnitsa during the most holy of all services and drove all men, women, and children out of Muggelnitsa and made them journey by foot to Warsaw to be interned in the ghetto. The very old, the very young, and the infirm who could not make this journey afoot were killed and left by the wayside. Very few of our dear ones survived the ghetto or the gas chamber of Auschwitz and Dachau. We're proud to note, however, that in the heroic battle of the Warsaw ghetto, many of our own Muggelnitsa youth gave a good account of themselves. Men like Bendit Sigelman and Herschel Fankel, who went down fighting like heroes, striking down many of the Nazi beasts as they fell. Many escaped to Russia and from there to DP camps via Germany. When the United States Army reached Germany, many of our kinsmen were liberated, and they made their way to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel. That's community. That's caring for the people who came from you and following them and weeping when they are no more. We have a world to rebuild here. We have a world to rebuild in the land of Israel. In the land of Israel, after all, when the Jewish people came there, we found it defaced and desolate. This was, by the way, Winston Churchill's rationale for supporting the Jewish people in the Jewish land. You may not know that. He said, when the Jews, when the first Zionists came to Israel, they found a desert. And all of a sudden, the desert was changed overnight. He said, how does this people not deserve the land that they made into a modern land? But it is not fully rebuilt, and it still needs us to fulfill all the hopes of those first people who walked bedraggled and bereft out of the DP camps of Germany to rebuild Eretz Yisrael. Because it is true that Jews cannot and dare not care only about Jews, but let me tell you a story. When I was teaching at Hunter College in New York, I had a student who came up to me and said, today is the rally for Soviet Jewry, and today is also the anti-apartheid rally. Can you give me a reason why I should go for the rally to free Soviet Jewry instead of the anti-apartheid rally? And I said, you know, it's very important that you go to the anti-apartheid rally. I don't want to deny that. But I have a question for you. If you go to the anti-apartheid rally, who will go to the Free Soviet Jewry rally? If the Jewish people does not care for Jews across the world who face a rising wave of anti-Semitism, if we don't rebuild their world, if we don't take care of Israel, if we don't educate our children, who will do it? You think the world is out there getting ready to take care of Jews? If you think so, then I remind you that the great scholar from UCLA, Saul Friedlander, the scholar of the Holocaust, just completed his second volume, Years of Extermination, 1939 to 1945, which every reviewer is saying takes its place as the standard history alongside that of Raoul Hilberg, of the Holocaust. And this is what he writes in that book. Throughout Europe, not one social group, not one religious community, not one scholarly institution or professional association in Germany or anywhere in Europe declared its solidarity with the Jews. Not one. That's why I have all these names, page after page, of the Muggelnitzer who are no more. So you tell me who's going to give the money to educate Jewish children or to rebuild Israel. Those shattered and vanished worlds that we're trying to resurrect in the most powerful way, as the Kotzker Rebbe said, I was given the power to resurrect the dead, he said, but I choose to do something more difficult, which is to resurrect the living. To take a Jewish child who doesn't have an education and give him one. To take a tiny little besieged land in the Middle East and make it stand on its own 2 feet again. And that's the third world that we have to rebuild, which is the world of memory. Recapturing the ideals and the hopes of those who came before us. And these three are one: learning, land, and memory. Israel helps us recapture our memory. Let me give you an example. I don't know how many of you have ever heard of a small place called Chorvat Etri, the ruins of Etri. Etri was a village a long time ago. It's about 15 miles outside Jerusalem. And 2,000 years ago, this little village of Etri rose up against the Roman Empire, and it was smashed and destroyed. And it was gone from history. Everyone who fought there, everyone who lived there, everyone who died there was gone. Covered over with rubble and forgotten by the world. But you see, now Jews have the land of Israel. And we are uncovering our past. And the archaeologists lately have been, in fact, digging at Etri. And they have discovered the remains of this tiny village. They found the synagogue. They found the coins. They found some of the writings of the people of Etri. They found their mikveh, their ritual bath, and discovered that it was used as a mass grave, where they found the skeletal remains of Jews who died there 2,000 years ago, including men and children and women and a pregnant woman. All these people who otherwise would be lost to history, who are resurrected in our memory. A recent article in Biblical Archaeology Review talks about the excavations at Etri. And the last line of the article reads as follows: Etri was never settled again by Jews. It was gone. It was over. But we remember them. We rebuild their world of memory, because in that village 2,000 years ago, our ancestors thought there was something worth dying for. Something that we believe is worth living for. Jewish meaning. Jewish memory, Jewish learning, Jewish land. It once seemed impossible. These things could never be preserved for thousands of years. It couldn't happen. How could a people faced with such challenges possibly succeed? And the only way was to ignore the fact that it was impossible. To do in a historical sense what in that famous story Lord Nelson did. You know, if you go to England and you go to Trafalgar Square, you see this statue of Lord Nelson. It was he whose naval battles turned back Napoleon and preserved the sovereignty of the British Empire. That's why he gets a statue. Nelson was wounded in battle several times. He was blind in one eye. And at the Battle of Copenhagen, in the famous story, he was ordered to retreat by his commanding officer. And he took the scope and he put it to his blind eye and he said, "I'm sorry, but I can't see the order." And he continued to fight and he won. The only way the Jewish people could survive was to turn a blind eye to everything that told them to give up. Day after day, week after week, year after year, and generation after generation. We live in a society where there are constant temptations to triviality. They're all around us. And in learning, in memory, in Israel, we're fighting a battle. We do know what should be changed. We do. We know what it is that we have to alter. The people of Etri were in many ways like the people of Auschwitz. They are remembered, too many of them, for their deaths. But we have the fleeting, fantastic gift of life. For thousands of years, the Jewish people have been in the business of rebuilding worlds. It's what we believe in. It's what we do. Not everyone does. You may assume this is a universal human trait, but it's not. During the Spanish Civil War, the great existentialist Basque philosopher Miguel de Unamuno was teaching classes at Salamanca, and he refused to take a political stand despite what the Franco government was doing. But one day he was in his class and he was lecturing. And outside the window, he heard the Francoist army, and they were shouting, "Viva la muerte!" Long live death. And this is what Unamuno said to his class. "I've heard a cry today that is against everything that is possibly human, and now I have to stop." And from that day on, he began to speak out. That cry, the cry of death, is heard in the world. We have heard it throughout our history. It is not new to us. We know where it leads. We know what it is. But that is not our cry. Our cry is Ubacharta Bechayim, choose life. And life means learning, it means community, it means land, it means memory. We have a Yizkor service not because we idealize death, but because we cherish life. And we believe that the memory of those who have come before us enriches and deepens and elevates our souls. We choose community because all of life that is really meaningful is lived by grasping the hands of those whom we love. We choose learning because we are a people long tested, but we have never given up our faith and hope in the future. As we gather today, to remember all those who are gone, we should also gather to make a pledge to all those who will follow us, that we too will leave a legacy of learning, a legacy of memory, a legacy of a rebuilt land, and just like those who came before us, a legacy of dreams that do not die.
Shana Tova.